Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 25th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on federal monitoring of local policing. My name is Christian Corrigan and I'm Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts to discuss the topic. The first is Professor Samuel Walker, who is an emeritus professor of criminal justice at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And the second is Professor William G. Otis, who is an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center. More complete bios of both of our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call and on our website, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations and followed by your questions. So we're going to get things started today with a presentation from Professor Walker, and then we're going to have some commentary from Professor Otis after. So Professor Walker, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to speak on this topic. It's in the news. It's a very important topic, very important in terms of policing and in terms of some just general legal principles about the role of the federal government. I want to begin by just very quickly setting the framework for this. The 1994 Violent Crime Control Act, specifically Section 14141, authorized the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, to bring civil suits against law enforcement agencies where there was a pattern or practice of violation of civil rights. Now, right away, I want to clarify these are civil suits directed against organizations. Many people misunderstand that. They think they're, you know, criminal actions. That's done by a different part of the Justice Department. And so there are no remedies for individuals who feel they've been victimized. To date, there have been, you know, a large number of investigations of individual departments. The department is reluctant to, really provide specific numbers on these preliminary investigations because, you know, in some cases they don't find that significant a problem. But there have been slightly more than 20 settlements with law enforcement agencies. Now, I say settlement because some of them are consent decrees with the department. Others are memoranda of understanding with the departments. Actually, those settlements are with the cities. To date, there have been no trials. I mean, no city has said, forget it. We're not going to sign any consent decree. You know, sue us. Take us to trial. So that hasn't happened, and that's an interesting point we might want to discuss. The settlements are basically, with some local variation, all the same. They require three basic reforms in a police department. The first involves a state-of-the-art use of force policy. We might say that most of the investigations are prompted by pattern or practice of excessive use of force. Now, the use of force policy includes not just the formal written statement of what officers can and cannot do with respect to force, but especially important, the investigation of use of force incidents and allegations of excessive force. The second core element are what are known as early intervention systems. An early intervention system, or EIS, is a computerized database of police officer performance with anywhere from 5 to 25 performance indicators. Uses of force, citizen complaints, resisting arrest charges filed against the officer being named in civil suits, sick leave. Sick leave turns out to be a very potent indicator of something deeper. When you then run the numbers on the officers, it helps you identify the small group of officers at the far end of the scale who are repeatedly involved in problematic behavior. Too many, more uses of force incidents than their peer officers, more complaints, and so on. The officer is not guilty at that point. An EIS is separate from the discipline process. It looks for patterns, officer behavior, and when an officer is identified, is then subject to some kind of intervention by the department to correct the problems. That might be retraining. It might be counseling. It might be that, you know, personal counseling. It could be professional counseling and substance abuse and so on. And then a follow-up, on whether that intervention was effective. The third component is an improved citizen complaint process. Citizen complaint is on a constitutional level a First Amendment right to petition your government. And many citizen complaint processes in departments around the country they're not open, they're not accessible, they're not available in different languages, and so on. So those are the three basic reforms that are found in essentially all of the different settlements by the Justice Department. The other important part of these settlements include a court-appointed monitor. This person is appointed by the court, is an officer of the court, and the monitor is actually typically a team of experts, not just a single person. And the function of the monitor is to ensure the implementation of the reforms I just mentioned, and to report to the court and to report to the public. So it's a very valuable and I think important window into a police department. You really find out a lot about what's going on and what's not happening that should be happening, and so on. The settlements are, I think, every one that I'm familiar with lasts for 5 years. And that's important to put a deadline on this. Probably more than half have been extended for more years because they were not in full compliance at the end of that period. And when the monitor reports to the judge that the department is in compliance, the consent decree is then dissolved, and the judge and the monitor go away, and the department is now on its own. I should say that there's a lot of misunderstanding about these federal interventions. It is not a takeover, and the Justice Department does not control the police department. So basic operations of patrol and criminal investigation, that those are untouched. The court-ordered, or at least the consent decree reforms, apply, you know, just to the specific issues that I mentioned. So there's a lot of mythology and misunderstanding about that. Now, of the 20 settlements, the 20 some settlements that have been concluded, this includes Los Angeles, New Jersey State Police, Washington D.C., Cincinnati, which is a very special case and is worth discussing. In all of those cases, the final report of the monitor concluded that the department had been substantially transformed for the better. So that evidence that we have, the monitor's reports, suggest that this is an effective reform. I did a study of this several years ago. It's in the George Mason Civil Rights Law Review. And on the basis of that evidence and other evidence, I personally regard the federal intervention as an important and effective means of reforming a deeply troubled police department. So that's what we have, and there's a lot there for us to discuss.
Excellent. Professor Otis?
Well, thanks very much. I want to thank the Federalist Society and, in particular, Professor Walker for agreeing to talk about what is certainly a very timely topic. I worked for many years for the federal government and the Department of Justice in particular, both in Maine Justice and as an assistant U.S. attorney. I believe in the efficacy of federal power when properly applied. I understand, as does anyone of my generation, a baby boomer, some of the appalling abuses that went on, certainly in the 50s, 60s, going into the 70s in the South, of black people who wanted nothing more than to become full citizens and paid a steep price for it, sometimes at the hands of people who were in the police department by day and in the Klan by night. At the same time, and while I believe in federal power and used it myself for much of my career, I'm also not unsympathetic to the view that libertarians increasingly take, that there is excessive federal involvement in very many aspects of our public and civic life. And I want to kind of step back before I get into specifics and look at the landscape we're living in now. The federal government is a wet blanket all over the place. Look at the school systems. We have Common Core. The federal government tells you what has to be in your school lunch and what you can have as a snack, whether it's healthy for you or, in the government's view, not healthy for you. In healthcare itself, of course, we have the recent Obamacare legislation. The federal government now tells us when we must have health insurance, what penalty we'll pay if we don't, what the health insurance must cover, and what kinds we can get. In transportation, the federal government tells us what can be in our gasoline through its taxation, how much we have to pay, how much and what kind of safety equipment we have to have in our cars. That's no longer a market choice. And of course, when you go to everyone who takes the plane now knows what it's like to interact with federal power, with TSA, which has the right either to screen you or grope you, all depending on what the officer views as needed. Federal criminal law itself is growing, and libertarians, I think, have been correct in noting that the Department of Justice has become entwined in enforcing the regulatory state and doing so through a growing number of federal criminal statutes. Now the question, now let me turn specifically to the question we have today. What about the use of federal power in monitoring police departments? One thing that caught my attention when Professor Walker was speaking, he was outlining the three components of these consent decrees. And in the second one, he said that for local police departments that enter into these decrees, part of it is tracking sick leave. Now, there may well be circumstances in which officers who are taking a lot of sick leave are using it, you know, to consult a psychiatrist because they have anger problems. But there could be other reasons, and usually there are other reasons that police officers would go on sick leave. If their wife has a baby and they need to be at home, if they get mono, if they get injured on the job, as sometimes happens to policemen, all those can be reasons for what looks statistically as excessive sick leave. And the reason that in particular caught my attention is that if we have the federal government now tracking when individual police officers are calling in sick and when they're not, one must at least wonder whether the reach of the federal government has gone as far as libertarians often accuse it of having gone. As respects this particular subject, I think that the reason we're having this call is an item much in the news, and that is the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, and that has kicked off the current curiosity and concern about the operation and the possible excesses of local police and the possible need for federal oversight. It seems to me that I want to start off by saying, as respects this, what does the Constitution envision as the role of the federal government in monitoring local police? And it's the answer to that question is not clear-cut, in my view. The text of the Constitution doesn't mention it specifically, but it has long been accepted in our country, beginning in the 1960s, and the well-publicized and appalling local police abuses there, that the federal government does have a legitimate role in some instances in monitoring local police. What is curious is that liberal friends of mine, in considering what has gone on in Ferguson, they will often say we need to learn the lessons of Ferguson as it applies to federal oversight of police, or we need to understand what Ferguson means for our country. And liberals, the same liberals who say these things are the liberals who in other contexts have repeatedly reminded us of the need for due process for individuals who might have committed a crime, although no one has yet been even accused of a crime in Ferguson. Liberals who often remind us that a case cannot be played out or tried in the press. Liberals who remind us that there should be no rush to judgment. But I don't hear those things coming from liberals in the context of Ferguson. As respects the proper role of the federal government, it seems to me that what the lessons of the 60s were, that we need federal oversight, and indeed we may need federal prosecutions for violations of civil rights, which is the polite name for murdering blacks, which happened in the 60s. We need federal oversight when local oversight cannot succeed, as it could not in southern towns in the 60s, because local oversight was the whole problem. Local oversight was bigoted, and it could not be trusted to deliver justice. Is that the case in places like Ferguson? Well, we can start off with Ferguson itself. It seems to me it is not the case in Ferguson, and may well not be the case in other towns to which this will be applied. One kind of interesting thing that I found out when Ferguson showed up on the radar screen is that the population of Ferguson is now close to 70% black. Where you have the citizens, where blacks have that degree, a big majority in the representation, I don't know why the local community cannot be entrusted to oversee its own police force. I don't know why federal involvement is required. Where you have that degree of black representation, you can fire the mayor, you can fire the chief of police, and run the police department under local standards that you think best. One lesson that libertarians have taught us, although I have some sympathy for libertarian thinking, I am not myself a libertarian, but one valuable lesson of libertarianism is that local people know best their own concerns. Where local people are disabled, either by culture, tradition, law, or legal vestiges, from being able to impose justice and to have a fair and open system on their own, then I agree with Professor Walker that federal oversight may be needed. But that, it seems to me, under the Constitution and under a federal system of government, we need to look first to states and localities, and only in extreme instances to the federal government. I guess the last thing I'll say to leave our callers some time is that these consent decrees use the word consent in an odd fashion. When you have all the power and all the money of the federal government on one side and your town council on the other side, The consent decree may be consensual in the technical sense, but actually it is very hard, I know, having been in the Department of Justice, to buck what the department wants, because the department has resources that you don't have, and will be playing out the case ordinarily before a federal judge rather than a local judge. That's my take on it, and I'd be happy to take our callers' questions should they have any.
Well, great. Before we move to questions, Professor Walker, I just wanted to see, do you want to offer any thoughts on what Professor Otis said before we go to questions, or address anything that he brought up?
Yes, there are 2 points that I want to respond to. One, we can dispose of quickly. The other is, I think, a much more substantive issue. He picked up on the issue of the use of sick leave. I think he misunderstood what an early intervention system does. The federal government is not monitoring sick leave. It's the consent decrees direct police departments to develop early intervention systems. They may include sick leave as an indicator. They may not. All the police commanders I've talked to said it's a very good indicator, but that stays within the department. So there's not this. You know, federal surveillance of use of sick leave. The other point is point made toward the end, which is very important in terms of the role of local government, and that, you know, local people know best. Now, there are two major institutions in our society, police and public schools, which have been matters of historically local control. The problem in policing is that local governments have been really very irresponsible in terms of managing their police departments and establishing really professional standards. They don't really know the intricate details of policing, and police management is a very complex matter. And so in city after city across the country, this lack of professionalism has resulted in patterns of civil rights violations. And that's where the federal government has to step in, just as it had to step in the case of our history of civil rights, as Professor Otis mentioned. So it's really been, if a city runs a simply incompetent police department, that doesn't raise any, they're inefficient, you know, they don't control crime, and that doesn't necessarily raise any constitutional question. But when it results in the abuse of citizens' rights, then it does.
Now, would that be – so we're talking about the congressional power would be through Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, or the federal government's power?
Yeah, yes. But again, specifically, people should be familiar with the 1994 Violent Crime Control Act and Section 14141.
All right. Are we ready to move to questions?
I would say only one thing very, very briefly.
Sure.
Professor Walker mentioned the problem of local irresponsibility. No one with eyes to see could gainsay that we have that in various places, more than one, there is local irresponsibility and things worse than irresponsibility, discrimination and corruption. The point I would make in response is that local irresponsibility and even local corruption is the price we pay for federalism. And the overall benefits of federalism, of the dispersing of power among federal, state, and local governments, just as at the federal level, power is dispersed among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. The genius of federalism is that the founders knew that the real threat to our liberty is abuse of government. It's when the government itself is abusive. And the check on that is to disperse the powers of government, both across branches and from federal to state. So even though there can be and there are abuses, in my view, again, tolerating abuse is the price of the overall greater benefits of a federalism structure.
Well, I would respond. You and I agree on the principle of federalism, and I'm a very strong supporter of local control of police in particular. And the last thing we want is a national police force where there's a single control, such as you find in most other countries. So we're in tune with each other on that point. My position is that when the abuses reach the level of a pattern of civil rights violations, then there's a role for the government to step in. And just to keep in mind, I mentioned there have been 20 some settlements. Well, we have 15,000 police departments, so it's actually playing a fairly minor role in terms of the look at the full picture of American local policing.
All right. Well, let's go to questions now. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. That's star and the pound key. All right, looks like we have one question that jumped on the line. We'll go right to that.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. This addresses policies and practices which might tend to prevent abuses, but it doesn't really address the problem of justice for individual cases. And one wonders whether programs of this kind might not divert attention from proper pursuit of actions under 18 U.S.C. 241 and 242, or under 42 U.S.C. 1983. And in a noted passing that there's actually no constitutional authority to criminally prosecute federal actors if they violate people's rights. Secondly, there's a disturbing tendency on the part of many police departments, if you file a complaint against an officer, to prosecute the complainant for filing a false complaint. And finally, we need to perhaps address not just procedures, but standards for involving police culture and standards for force protection, perhaps relaxing standards of self-defense so that we no longer have a situation where police consider it better to lose 100 innocent civilians than one police officer and go back to a standard where it was better to lose 100 police officers than one innocent civilian.
Did you want a response to that?
Yeah, do either Professor Oates or Professor Walker want to comment on that?
Yes, just very quickly, he pointed out the problem of diverting energy and resources to problems with individual cases, especially under Section 1983. That hasn't happened. It's not going to happen. Those are really separate legal actions, the pattern practice effort that I talked about in the 1983 actions, and you often see them both going forward simultaneously involving somewhat often the same events. That really is not a danger there.
Maybe if I could just say two things. The first is that people should be prosecuted for filing false police reports. The key there is whether or not it's false. If a report of police conduct is true, of course you should, the person filing it should not be prosecuted. And indeed, it works the other way around. The policeman should be, if not prosecuted, all depending on the nature of the correctly reported misconduct, should be disciplined or fired, or something should happen. But this should not dissuade us from discouraging the filing of false accusations against the police, which are no better than false accusations against anyone else. They should be discouraged, and a person who files such a thing should face a disincentive for doing it. The second thing I want to say is that the caller's view, if I heard this correctly, that instead of losing 100 innocent civilians to one dead police officer, we should have 100 police officer killed, 100 police officers killed for every one civilian that gets killed is appalling. And it has no place in a civil discussion. We shouldn't have, look, the law of self-defense is settled, and it is the same for police officers as it is for everyone else. The law of self-defense is that a person may use deadly force to defend himself if he has an objectively reasonable belief of imminent grave bodily harm or death. And what we need to do is simply enforce the existing standard both against police and against people who threaten the police. But the idea that, you know, society should accept 100 dead police officers in order to reform the police force is, as I say, it has no place in this discussion.
I would agree with that completely.
All right. Looks like we've got one more question on the line. We'll go to that, or two questions on the line, actually. We'll go to those. Oh, had three jump on.
This is Mike Tremoli. Excuse me, Mike Tremoli from the Philadelphia chapter. The federal, well, first of all, Bill, I agree with you on that. I concur with the idea that the standard of 100 dead police officers for one innocent civilian is absurd. I've never heard of that standard. I used to be a police officer in Philadelphia. I've never heard of that standard. And I think it's indicative of the of this lynch mob mentality that seems to have arisen over the past couple of years. And let me give you a couple of examples. Recently, there was an actress down in Los Angeles, Danielle Watts, who claimed that she was unjustly stopped by the police, refused to identify herself, said it was a racist, it was a product of racism. The stop was nothing more than just a racist police officer, and that she wasn't doing anything except kissing her boyfriend. When it came out that the police officer had been dispatched to her location because they got a complaint of somebody having sex in the car, and that the police officer had no intention of arresting anybody, but when she started refusing to identify herself, when she started complaining and yelling and screaming, he had no choice but to do so. Many people immediately presumed that the police officer was racist and the police officer was harassing her and the police officer was acting unjustly. Typically, this is the type of thing that happens. And I ask people very often, I give them a scenario, and I'm still waiting for answers from people, something that happened to me once. And that was, I got a call for a burglary in progress. I show up at the house with somebody backing me up, another police officer. I'm the only white police officer there. Everybody else is black involved. Go to the house, knock on the door. I peek in through the window. There's two guys sitting there. Both have a can of beer in their hands. They're watching a baseball game on television. One of them comes to the door. I said, what's going on? Anything, everything okay? He said, yeah, fine. Now, if I would have asked for ID and they would have refused and there would have been a commotion there, I would have been accused of being a racist. Okay? I didn't ask for ID. I was a rookie. I didn't know any better. I started walking away. The senior man, a guy named Simon, grabbed me. I said, wait a minute. Let's go back into the house. He demands their ID. They start acting up. You don't have a right to do this. You don't have a right to do that. Two elderly women come from upstairs, and they start saying, what's going on? Truncated version is both of these men were burglars. These women were upstairs sound asleep in their house. When they heard the police pull up, they went to the refrigerator, got out the beers, turned on the television set, so we wouldn't think there was anything wrong. Now, this is the type of situation that I would suggest routinely police officers face, at least in the most controversial cases. Why are police automatically presumed by some people in society to be wrong?
Would you like a response to that?
Yeah, please.
Well, let's bring up Ferguson. And when we talk about what routinely happens, and it goes to the first case that you mentioned earlier, the whole episode began. Michael Brown was jaywalking in the middle of the street. The officer pulls up and says, "Get the F on the sidewalk." That is disrespectful, unprofessional language. And the fact of the matter is, that happens all the time, every single day, and all across this country. And what it has done is build up this reservoir of distrust of the police.
How do you know that's what the police officer said?
There has been testimony, and there's been no testimony contradicting.
By whom? What testimony? There is no trial yet, sir.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'll drop the word testimony. I said there have been.
There has been no trial yet. You were acting as judge, jury, and executioner, and yet you are one who portrays himself as being a proponent of civil liberties.
No.
But you were already condemning the police officer.
No witnesses come forward.
And not only that, you're saying this happens all the time. You have no idea what happens.
It does happen. There's plenty of research.
You don't know that.
There's plenty of
you
research.
You have no idea if this happens. You show me the studies where this has been indicated.
There's plenty of research on disrespectful language.
Show it to me.
All right. Let's take a step back here. Professor Walker, do you want to continue your answer?
The point is there's this reservoir of distrust of the police. And so
the people
that,
like you.
Yeah, so that when you have an incident such as the one with the actress in Los Angeles, this whole historic memory of bad relations with the police immediately comes to the forward. If the officer had said, "Excuse me, sir, I would like you to get over on the sidewalk. You're jaywalking, you're breaking the law, you're a danger to yourself and to traffic." If it had been respectful, stern, authoritative, police would do this all the time, we would build up better relations between the police and the public, and especially the African-American community. That's the core of the problem, right there.
We've actually got four more questions on the line. Professor Otis, did you want to offer any thoughts on that?
There are only two observations I would have. One is that by its nature, police work is such that the citizen is not going to be left happier. He's not. When you have, I used to be a federal prosecutor. I never been arrested for anything. I had only the same interactions with the police that most people do, which is to say that occasionally I get stopped for speeding or running a stop sign. And when that happens to me, I don't like it. And it doesn't make any difference it does make some difference, but mostly it makes little difference how the police officer approaches me. Like other human beings, I tend to be self-justifying. And what I tell myself, although I don't tell the officer, is that, well, there wasn't anything wrong with speeding because it's a clear day and I wasn't endangering anyone and there's little traffic and I don't know why you're doing this to me rather than going off after some guy who's dealing methamphetamine. So the first thing is that by nature, police work is not going to court popularity. That is not to say, and it is not to excuse or in any way encourage disrespectful police. Police are going to find their own jobs easier if they're respectful. And to be honest, when I was pulled over, the policeman was, I thought, businesslike in every occasion. Now, that's just one person's experience. The other thing I would say is that on the whole, what we hear about are the police encounters that turn out to be either a disaster or a crime or a tragedy. There are zillions, I don't know what the number is, there are many, many police citizen interactions, I don't know, probably thousands a day. And on the whole, the police, although their interactions are, as I say, by their very nature, not going to spark a lot of popularity, on the whole, police act in a way that is professional. And I guess one third thing I would say is that it's fair to take note that over the last 20 years, even as people have become more aware of civil liberties, and civil liberties have enjoyed, in my view, greater protection than at any time in American history, police work has succeeded. The crime rate, which is the main thing that the police try to suppress, is now half what it was 20 years ago. So while we are properly critical of disrespectful or unnecessarily forceful police work, there's another side to that story, and I think we should be grateful for the additional safety we have now that we did not have a generation ago, in part because of improved professionalism and accuracy in police work.
Well, it looks like we have five questions pending and about 20 minutes to go, so I would ask our callers to please keep your questions as brief as possible. And also, please do make sure you actually ask a question of our caller. So we'll move right on to them. A question of our experts.
Hi, Eric Friday with Florida Carry in Florida. Given the numerous cases that we have seen, and while certainly, you know, one video that is posted online equates to Lord knows how many interactions that police officers have every day. But given the number of videos that have now been posted, either of citizens or police dash cams, that have absolutely proven errors in their police reports, does that indicate a need for increased accountability through videographic evidence by either better affirming citizens' rights to record or by requiring police officers to be issued cameras? And secondly, in addition to the increased accountability that comes from that, does the fact we've seen this show a need for increased accountability? And secondly, given that humans are fallible, mistakes do happen, and we're balanced, you know, not to support what the gentleman said earlier about how many dead police officers versus how many dead citizens, but how do we balance that? What is the acceptable rate of error before we do take action in a given situation? I mean, is it acceptable, and do we have to accept the concept that sometimes police officers are going to make mistakes and innocent people will be harmed, but because of the risk of police work, they're not to be held accountable or to be held to a much lower standard, such as in one case I recently read, did the officer have arguable probable cause to justify his actions?
Well, I want to respond very quickly. The police-worn body cameras have come out of the blue. It's a brand new accountability measure, and it's spreading very quickly. It's very important. It's going to make a very positive contribution by having the most complete objective record that we will be able to get, and the studies that are beginning to come in show that they have a very positive effect in reducing complaints and reducing officer use of force. And in many cases, I've talked to people who are doing these studies. The body cam evidence does not support the citizen complaint. It supports the officer's point of view. So this is you're right that this kind of video evidence is good, it's valuable, and it's going to make a huge difference in the years to come.
If I could just say three things in response to that. I'm all for accountability. I was a prosecutor for most of my career, and the whole deal was to require accountability for people who broke the law, and it didn't make any difference to me what profession or what walk of life they came from. If they violated the statute, federal statute, then it was my job, and I welcome the job, and I'm proud to have had it, to require accountability. As to video evidence, I am also in favor of video evidence because it is contemporaneous. It's the best evidence. I'm for it for the same reason that I was always in favor of videotaping station house interviews with suspects. And the reason for that was not just, or indeed not primarily, for the reasons that, for example, the ACLU often says, to catch the police at effectively coercing the suspect to incriminate himself. What you're actually going to see on the police tape far more often is a guilty defendant trying to weasel his way out of it and telling a series of lies. And I would like to have that tape to show to the jury if he's foolish enough to turn down the lenient plea bargain he's going to be argued. And the final thing I would say is that while I am in favor of videotaping and police videotaping their behavior and other people being able to videotape it, I think someone like our caller who identified himself as being from Florida, Cary, would do well to reconsider whether he really wants to have the federal Justice Department, which has done everything it can do in an antagonistic way toward Second Amendment rights, to be in on the action at the local level.
All right. Well, we've got four more questions on the line. We'll try to get to as many as possible before the end of the hour.
Hi, this is Gina Letario from SAVE. I'm a recent graduate from law school, and currently I'm working on legislation that tackles a kind of separate issue, not necessarily Ferguson-related, but I am working on campus sexual assault panels at campuses, and as I'm sure you are aware, that's kind of a hot topic right now. I'm currently working on legislation for a number of reasons, I guess, particularly for due process concerns. I don't think that Title IX is correct in directing campus disciplinary board hearings to be handling these types of cases. I guess, you know, there's a lot of due process concerns. They just don't have the resources or experience or expertise to be handling these. So I'm working on a bill that would direct these types of sexual assault allegations on campus back to local law enforcement instead of universities handling them. I was wondering, is there any sort of constitutional concern I should have there with the federal government saying that these cases should be directed to local law enforcement?
Well, the only thing I would add is that if you have an investigation of some alleged crime, those investigations need to be conducted by people who are trained and experienced in that activity. And you cannot have someone who has no background in you know, investigations, you know, interrogations and so on. So I share your due process concerns.
I also do. The due process concerns are especially heightened in what I've been hearing is how campuses deal with allegations of rape. Rape is an extremely serious crime, to say the least. But persons accused of rape are no more presumed guilty than persons accused of any other serious crime. But it seems to me increasingly campus codes do presume guilt. I have read about some that forbid the accused student from having a lawyer and severely circumscribe his opportunity to cross-examine the accuser. I would much prefer that the local police, that an accusation of rape be taken to the local police. If it's false, the person accused will have more due process protections going through court than he will through, you know, what is cobbled together as a campus disciplinary proceeding. If, on the other hand, he is guilty, he will face the deserved punishment of going to jail, possibly for a long time, rather than just having to go to an anger management course or, at worst, getting expelled. Rape deserves more than that if the allegation is true.
I agree completely.
All right. Well, we've still got two questions left now, and we've got about 10 minutes, so we should be able to get to both of them.
Hey, this is Rod Sullivan at Florida Coastal School of Law. And I guess I want to direct this question first to Professor Walker. Going back to the Mahoney versus Holder case, we have 150 police officers, 125 police officers, alleging that the federal government has violated their civil rights. However, under 1983, they cannot sue the federal government for violation of the Civil Rights Act and can't recover their attorney's fees. Now, they haven't been able to find an attorney to assist them in their case against the federal government, I would assert primarily because there's no right to attorney's fees under 1983. So the question to you is, shouldn't people who assert that their civil rights have been violated by the federal government be entitled to the same protections as people who assert their civil rights have been violated by state governments?
Well, the issues in that particular case are you know, really beyond my expertise, and I'm just going to be reluctant to jump in there.
Professor Otis? Yep. Professor Otis, do you want to?
I want to exercise much of the same circumspection and modesty as Professor Walker. I'm not familiar with that particular case. I would say more broadly that there is a reason that police and prosecutors enjoy partial immunity from suits. The reasons are explained in the Supreme Court case, I think from 1974, at least on the prosecution side, by the name of Imbler versus Pachtman. And the basic reasoning is that, look, then, as I've been saying, I was a prosecutor for a long time. There are very few people who actually think they belong in jail. No matter how guilty they are, they all think they got railroaded there by something, you know, unfair or dastardly that the cops or the agents or the prosecutors do. So what they will do is they will sit in jail and just write suit after suit, and they will file these in court demanding that the cop or the agent or the prosecutor be called to account for his execrable and illegal behavior. Criminals in jail have no expenses to bear, and their time isn't exactly occupied with other things they need to do. So the incentives to file suits against the authorities are high, the costs are low, and the burden on the administration of justice in requiring official actors to answer what can be an unlimited number of suits that don't have to have any merit at all is very high indeed. I know that the doctrine of sovereign immunity or any partial immunity really rubs people the wrong way, and it seems very unfair, but there are actually good reasons for it, and I urge people on this call to read Justice Lewis Powell's opinion for the court in Imbler versus Pachtman.
All right. Well, we've got one last question to get to and a few minutes left, so we'll go ahead and get to that before we end the call.
Hi, this is Andrew Bondarude in Jacksonville, Florida. And it's a great segue, the last question and answer, because I actually was wanting to ask a question about the Imbler decision and the absolute prosecutorial immunity. It seems to me there's good reason for police officers to have qualified immunity, but as it stands right now, prosecutors have total immunity, absolute immunity from suit, not just from liability, but from any suit whatsoever, even a proceeding. And so it seems to me that occasionally people will have their rights violated by a prosecutor, and yet the only remedy or recourse against that prosecutor would be at the ballot box. And if the individual whose rights were violated happens to be a felon, then that individual has no recourse against the prosecutor whatsoever. I wanted to just raise this issue for the two speakers and ask if they had any comments or reflections on the disparity of immunity that's granted to prosecutors and police officers.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a law professor, and the whole issue of immunity is one that's really outside my area of expertise, so I'm going to pass.
I would say that it doesn't bother me that the remedy is at the ballot box rather than in court. The judicial branch is the least democratic of the branches and is supposed, as was once famously said, to be the least dangerous branch. If we start looking to the judicial branch to remedy every wrong that can be brought to it, it will not be the least dangerous branch for long. Indeed, it will completely overtake the authority of the other branches. The very idea of democratic self-government, which is the central idea that underlay the founding of the country, is that the political branches must be primarily responsible for redressing the grievances of the citizens. And that's how I would leave it.
All right. Well, we've got a couple minutes left. So I just want to give both Professor Walker and Professor Otis an opportunity to make any closing statements or address any final points that they think they may have left out or not had the opportunity to address before we end. So maybe start with you, Professor Walker. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, it's been a very good discussion. I've enjoyed it. Just one thing for all the listeners, and for especially the caller from Philadelphia, on the evidence of what happens routinely out there in terms of traffic stops. Great new book, which came out this year by Charles Epp, EPP, called Pulled Over. It's a study of traffic stops in the Kansas City area. Dynamite study. I mean, just the racial divide between the experiences of whites and versus African Americans is very powerfully documented. Read it.
Great. Professor Otis, any concluding thoughts?
Two. First is the most important thing to remember is that the episodes that are brought to public attention are a tiny fraction of 1% of the episodes that actually go on every day in police-citizen encounters. And for by far the most part, the police behave themselves, even though no one actually likes dealing with one. The second thing is that we should not forget, in the heat even of what is possibly an egregious moment, as was exemplified in Ferguson, that we need first to ask and have the patience to wait to find out what actually happened. This is true of encounters between police and citizens as it is in any other case of public importance. To use Ferguson as an example, it could be the case that the officer committed cold-blooded murder, that this 18-year-old black man was attempting to surrender, was just walking with his hands up toward the policeman, and out of sheer racial hate, the policeman blew him away. That could be what happened. If that happened, in my mind, that's where the jury should be entitled to consider the death penalty. On the other hand, it could be the case that the policeman stopped him, and what eventually happened is that the black 18-year-old rushed the policeman, and the black, it happened, the deceased, was bigger than your average NFL lineman. And the policeman could well have been in objectively reasonable fear of imminent grave bodily harm or death, in which case what happened was a tragedy, but it's what the police or anyone else in that situation would be legally entitled to do. And the answer is not to jump to conclusions, to allow due process to take its course and then decide what needs to happen, not decide now.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both professors for joining us today. Thank you to our audience for listening along and offering your questions. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Just a reminder that you can catch this podcast or this telephone conference call posted as a podcast on our website in the next few days, as well as all of our other previous telephone conference calls. So we look forward to hearing you on the next one. And until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.